This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
Well, we're glad to see everybody. It's obviously summertime and everything is slowing down. We're seeing, despite what I'm preaching about, we're seeing lots of selfies of people traveling all around, and that's very funny. And so we're happy to have you here. All of you. I want to, first of all, this is sponsored by the St. David's Church Foundation. And April, as you know, is our Director of Stewardship and Plan Giving, and she does a fabulous job. She also kind of runs Corral on the St. David's Foundation, keeps it going. It's a great group. They manage all of our endowments, and man, they help us with that, with the policies around that, with the building of the endowments. And so they are sponsoring this presentation from John. And John, we're really excited to have you back. John's been here before. But before I say that, I've been asked to tell you that I know a lot of you that already have wills, and I commend you for thinking ahead and planning well with your families. That's what we're going to talk about for a little while. But I also want to take this opportunity to thank those of you who have put St. David's in that conversation. Whether you have put St. David's in your will or you're in conversation with your family about how you want to give gifts to the church for the long legacy that this parish will have long after all of us are gone. So I appreciate your generosity and able. I also want to recognize our foundation directors. Do we have any members of the foundation board in here? Yes, very good. Thank you all. Y'all thank them for their work. All right, he has spent over 40 years in church administration, stewardship, direct response marketing, and planned giving. I think that qualifies him for 45 minutes of your time. He's worked for the Presbyterian Church USA Foundation and the National Benevolence Association. He was administrator at the Village of Presbyterian Church in Kansas City and gift planning officer for St. John's Episcopal Cathedral in Denver, Colorado. If you've never been there, that's where it stopped. That's a pretty gorgeous place. Yeah. For the last 18 years, he served as a senior philanthropic advisor for St. Francis Community Service, which I assume he's going to tell us a little bit about. He continues in that role from a newly formed St. Francis Foundation. St. Francis is an Episcopal-affiliated ministry serving over 11,000 children and families in 5 different states. John works with individuals and their families to creating legacy plans that fulfill donors' desires to benefit charities and ministries to families. John, I'll let you say whatever else you want to say.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you. Let me just kind of update you a bit on St. Francis Ministries. We've been through a number of different names over the years, and we're now St. Francis Ministries. We are affiliated with the Episcopal Church, and what that means basically is we don't get money from the Episcopal Church, but we embrace the Episcopal tradition of service. Our CEO, all of our top folks are indeed priests. So that is, we are now in 6 states. We have just signed a contract here in Texas, up in the Amarillo, Texas area, for whatever region that is of your social service work here. We're also in Arkansas and in Mississippi, Nebraska, Kansas, I think that's 6, close, something like that. And we're also now in 3 Central American countries. We are in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. And I'm just taking on a new role to build a new donor base for our work there. And I just want to say, no, there will not be an ask other than to remember St. David's. Yeah. Nor will we pass the plate, nor do I have any pledge cards with me. So, no, we actually, it's kind of fascinating. When our staff comes in to preach, we preach they preach the lectionary. And we don't make asks. People can inquire. We're always glad for people to inquire. But the work that we're doing in Central America is really fascinating, and this is not a political statement. This is just a fact of reality. We deal with kids at both ends of the spectrum. Kids who have come across unaccompanied wind up in foster care programs. Every state that we work in, we have kids that wind up in foster care programs that have come across unaccompanied. The work that we're doing in those countries, though, are trying to build a community. We've started a Montessori school. We're creating jobs. We just purchased 65 acres of land to grow and sell moringa oil and powder, which I don't know much about that other than it's supposedly a hot item because we have distribution channels already set up. So we'll be able to employ the folks in El Salvador, create a revenue stream for them that will flow back to them. So that's the kind of work that we're doing, both in the United States and here. We deal with foster care, adoption. We adopted over 450 kids last year. Almost all of our kids come to us through the court system. The courts have said this child needs to be removed from their home, and our first effort is to try to reconnect them to their biological home. If that's not possible, then foster care, adoption. We also do a lot of family preservation. And then in our Kansas area, we have a adolescent psychiatric hospital because most states have shut down a lot of mental health for youth. And if they don't go there, they oftentimes will wind up in prison. So we're working hard to keep that from happening. So that's just kind of something about me that I've been doing it, well, as Father said, for 40 years, so. And if you were here last time, just because there was a fear that you might have been here last time, I actually have put together a whole new presentation, so. But anyway, about 3 months ago, I was at lunch with six other plan-giving type folks, and only two of us were still working, and not working all that hard, but two of us were still in the field. Everybody else was retired. And we started having this discussion about the strangest question that we'd been asked. And I got to thinking about questions around the whole estate area and how we can help people look at their legacy planning based on some of those questions. And so I sat down and began to build some thoughts around those questions. So this is a presentation that's an epic presentation that's 40 years in the making. I'm fairly certain I'll not win any awards on this, but that's okay. So when I looked at all of this, there were three areas that really stood out for me. Questions that I have been asked, questions that I think you should make sure you ask your attorney, and then some questions that I would have for you today. So those are the three things that we're going to really look at and try to deal with. So on those questions that I have been asked, time and time again, I'm always asked, do I really need a plan? The answer is, if you're content with your county and your state making a plan for you, no, you don't. You don't need to make a plan because they will indeed have one for you. Now, I will promise you that they will not be charitable as they administer that plan. No matter how long you've been at St. David's as a member, if you don't have a plan, the state's not going to say, he was a good old guy, so we're going to give some money to St. David's because he was a member there. It's not going to happen. So do you need a plan? Yes. And the more complicated your life becomes, the greater the need for that plan. The larger your wealth might be, your family situation, if you're in a blended family, it's really important to have that plan. The other question that I'm often asked is, do I really need an attorney? Now, that usually is somewhere around the fact of, do I really need an attorney because they cost so much? I think that's a great myth. The reality for me is that unless you have a really complicated estate, you're not going to spend that much. And whatever you spend is going to be worthwhile. If you have a very complicated estate situation for your legacy planning, you definitely need an attorney. If you stay up late at night and watch TV, and you see the fact that for 1995 you can write your own will, just, you know, but wait, there's more, we'll let you write two wills, for another 1995. So you can do that. And if you do it exactly the right way, it might stand up. I always recommend that you get qualified legal counsel and tax advice as you're looking at your legacy planning. I just think it's really important. I want to be clear, I'm not an attorney. I'm not a CPA. I don't sell any products. I'm just here as a gift planner to talk to you about what I think is the importance of legacy planning. And the question that I invariably ask is, how do I divide my estate for my kids? Because we feel guilty if we don't do equal shares to each kid, even though we may think or know that not all kids are equal in that regard, because I have a daughter, for example, who would spend until she didn't have any more to spend and then still spend some. I have a son who probably has about 95% of the first dollar he ever made. So, you know, how do you make that decision? I've worked with people who have children with special needs. I've worked with people who have children that they know will go through the money quickly, so they need to devise a way not to do that. They have kids who don't need it, kids who are very successful and don't really need to have that kind. So the real question is, first of all, in your own mind, how much are you willing to say, this child does, this child doesn't. This child needs this amount, this child needs that amount. You know, I need to be careful swinging this around. Sorry about that, folks. There we go. So you really have to decide where your comfort level is in terms of dealing with your children. But that's a question that I'm asked all the time, and I suggest that you have those discussions early in the legacy planning stage, because it will come up and it will be important, and you may need to explain to your children why you've made the decisions that you've made. So those are just three questions that over the years I've been asked over and over and over again. Now let's get into the really tough stuff, and that is questions that I think you want to make sure you ask your attorney. As you're working with your attorney, with your tax advisor, doing your legacy plan, they're going to probably ask you all of these. But you may want to create your own checklist so you'll know. First of all, is everything titled correctly? By that I mean just what it says. Now I know why you gave me this. Is everything titled correctly? I recently had a situation where a woman had three adult children. Dad had died probably 5 or 6 years ago, and she was doing her legacy planning. And as we talked, she had a will that specified that at her death, the house that was paid for, that was worth about $1.2 million where they live, would be split equally among the three children. However, after Dad died, she decided it would make life easier, so she retitled the house in her name and the daughter's name, the daughter that lived in the same town. And I said, well, you know, let me tell you what's going to happen here. At your death, the daughter owns the house, because she titled it joint ownership with right of survivorship. And she said, oh, well, I'm sure my daughter will do the right thing. And I said, well, let me just tell you. When my dad died with 58 cents in his pocket, and my brother and I decided there wasn't enough to get in the street and fight over all of that. But for a house that's worth $1.2 million, not to mention whatever else you might have, there will be family members who will fight over that. And many times an attorney will say to me, you know, I don't really make my billable hours by writing wills. I really make it by settling family fights. So just remember that and ask that question of how are things titled, because that is, I think, one of those really important aspects that you want to look at. Do I have all the correct documents? Do I have a durable power of attorney? Have I done the medical directives? Those are the kinds of documents you want to make sure. Is my will up to date? Because sometimes we will do a will and then we look at it 18 years later and realize this will is really out of date from a standpoint of taxes, from a standpoint of what's happened in the family. One of those questions you might want to ask is, do I need a revocable trust? It might be known as a living trust. It might be known as a grantor trust, depending on what part of the country you're in. But that's a question to ask. Would it make sense for me to have a revocable trust? Real quickly, how it works. It's the way I like to describe it is you're taking a bucket and you're putting everything that you own in that bucket. And you write on the side of the bucket how you want things to be handled. And you name an administrator who's going to administer what's in that bucket for you. Two things are going to happen, can happen. You drop the bucket and you pick it up and you rearrange it and you put it back in place, or you kick the bucket. When you kick the bucket, it's really important because what's in that trust is going to bypass probate. You have an administrator name that's going to make sure that what's in that bucket is distributed the way you have specified that it will be. So that's a question to ask, I think, is whether or not you need it. The next question that I think you should ask the attorney is, does my plan that I'm creating prevent family gridlock? I've seen more families torn apart because legacy planning was not properly done. I'm working with three siblings right now. And these are siblings that are in their 50s and 60s. And a brother died, and about the only thing the brother had left in life was a wonderful Steinway concert grand piano. One sister wanted to sell it. One sister thought she should keep it. And the other sister wanted to let the sister keep it after she bought it. So you had three different views of what should happen to the Steinway concert grand piano. And they're still fighting over it. Now, there's nothing else left in the state. What debt there was got paid off by what little money he had, but they're still arguing back and forth on the phone two or three times a week about the piano. A family that's in gridlock. Now, that's not good. That's not healthy for anyone, right? So ask those questions of these plans that I have in place. Does it prevent family gridlock? I had another family where the dad decided that he was going to finally have his will done. And he put a provision in the will that for all of the personal effects in the house, they were going to give the three kids monopoly money, and the kids would go in and bid on items in the house with the monopoly money. The only time in my career that I've ever had an attorney call and say, I kind of need your help on this. We need to talk him out of this. So we spent a lot of time finally convincing AJ that this was not the right way to do it. But had he gone on with that, can you imagine the kind of gridlock within that family? And so those are questions that you want to make sure you ask. The other one to ask is, am I clear on my charitable legacy? I need clarity in a couple of areas here. One is I want to be clear on where that money goes, what percent goes where. After you decide that you're going to give 50% to St. David's, well, that's just a number I pulled out. And then the other 50% you're going to give to your university or to your library or the ballet or wherever you want to give it. But you need to be clear about that. And you need to spell that out and make sure that's where you want that legacy to go. Yes, sir. No, I would say, and again, keep in mind, I'm not an attorney, but I would say if you just turn that in as a card to St. David's, unless that is specified in your will, in your estate plan, that legacy plan that you're putting together, no one's going to know that. Now, I suppose if it's considered a pledge, I've seen some churches willing to go to court. That's usually pretty bad move in terms of public relations for a church to. I really don't encourage that. My sense, and I think you ought to make sure you ask that question. But I don't. My interpretation would be no. That if that's not backed up by what's in your legacy plan, in your will, St. David's is going to be looking at a card going, oh, I wish he had done it. You know, does that answer the question of?
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
And there's also the church and the foundation, which are two very separate things. And so you have to specify that in your will if you're giving it to
I'm assuming that you say St. David's Episcopal Church Foundation or St. David's.
Right. Right, your question was, is that pledge card a legally binding? And I would say no, is my understanding of it.
Would it be fair to say that when we make that commitment to St. David's, we are under the assumption that you are, that it's mirrored in your estate planning with your mortgage and in your will. It's not.
What I would venture a guess to say is if you turn that card in, April's going to pick up the phone and call you and say, thank you, thank you, thank you. It's wonderful. I just want to make sure that you're comfortable with your legacy plan and you've included all of these instructions within that legacy plan. If you have not every church is blessed with having a staff person that does what April does. And so, you know, if you're going to, you know, 12th Street Church of the Nazarene, and you sign a pledge card there, and they don't have a staff person to follow up with you, and it's not in your will, that's all they have is just a piece of paper. So I'm not trying to say you have to do your job, but I assume that's what you would do. So does that answer the question? Okay. Any other while we're... So be clear on that legacy giving, because that's such an important part. Be clear with your family on that legacy giving. Kids need to know that mom and dad have been supporting David, St. David or St. Francis or whomever it happens to be. We have people that have been giving to us for 40 or more years at St. Francis. And I still discover people who gift us part of their legacy, and the kids had no idea that mom and dad had done that. Yes, sir.
I've got a question kind of related to what Michael was asking. We just had a capital campaign, and you know, we have to make a lot of decisions based on the pledges that are given. Does the church have any enforceable claim?
The I'm going to go back to my church administration days at this point. The question is around like a capital campaign where people have made pledges. Generally, those are not legally binding. And it kind of depends on how big the pledge was, too. I mean, there are universities, for example, who have gone to court. There are also universities who have canceled pledges because they didn't. In fact, the University of Alabama, I think it was Alabama, just had a case where a donor made a particular stand on a political issue, $26 million gift that he had pledged, and the university said, no, thank you. So it can go both ways. But and again, I think that's a question to make sure that you ask the attorney. But I don't believe that they're legally binding unless you put that kind of language in there. And I've never seen a church put that kind of language. So.
It seemed it'd be a good idea for April to remind all of us to be sure that that's in the will.
Right. Yeah. Just in case I can't fulfill my pledge to the capital campaign, I'm going to let the will do it, right? which really also, one of those decisions that you make is if I'm going to make a gift, and it's not totally out of the question to say, if I die before I complete that pledge, I would like for the residual of my estate to pay off that pledge. But you have to specify that. And, that's why you have resources to say, is it restricted? Is it unrestricted? Is there a particular ministry that I want to make sure that we underwrite? And don't just do it without consultation. I know when I was with the Presbyterian Foundation, we had a church in Detroit that had an endowed fund for painting Sunday school rooms, large, old downtown church building. One of the issues was that they didn't have a Sunday school. It was inner city church, and it was dying, and they had no Sunday school, which is probably one of the reasons it was dying, but that's a different story. But they painted that education building every year because they had an endowed fund that said, you gotta paint the Sunday school building. Don't put provisions like that in your plan without having some discussion. If it's so specific that it might not be around in 20 years, you may want to make it a more general designation of how you want that done. Now, I will tell you that there's generally not a development officer, a chief financial officer, a rector, a dean, whatever, that doesn't really relish unrestricted money. I'm just telling you. However, most donors like the thought of being able to direct how that money is going to be used. So this is this wonderful balance that you need to have some real discussion with the church, with the staff, about what you want that to do. You had a question back here.
Does the IRS give you a stepped-up valuation of debt assets that are appreciated?
When you pass that on, you mean?
When you die.
Yeah, when you die, there's usually a stepped-up value that goes. If you're dealing like with appreciated stock and those kinds of things, let me. Yeah. Yeah, and that's why this is in the section that says, be sure and ask your attorney. Because the last thing I want to do is give you incorrect information. Because the last thing you want to do is go someplace and quote somebody like me for crying out loud. I mean, that's not, but I think it's a valuable question that you want to make sure that you get asked. see where we want to go from here. Should I explore with my attorney more current gifts rather than necessarily legacy gifts? I'm going to go a tiny bit in the weeds here, but that's okay. You know, you're allowed to make gifts to individuals or institutions. You know, but allowed to make gifts to individuals that can pass tax-free. And I think this year it's in the neighborhood of $15,000 per person. I worked with a gentleman a few years back who had three married daughters, did not have a charitable bone in his body. Yeah, I talked till I was blue in the face about ways that he could, this was when you could actually help reduce taxes. This was before the tax act we have now, where if a couple has somewhere around $22, $24 million, you don't have to worry about taxes on your estate. He had to worry about taxes at that point in time. So I said, at least start giving your three daughters and your three sons-in-law, you know, that annual exclusion that you can make gifts because that will reduce your estate. And he didn't trust the son-in-laws all that much. And he was pretty sure that if he gave them to the daughters, the sons-in-law would wind up using it. He didn't always call them sons-in-law. He usually, there were other terms that he often used for them. So he didn't do it. He died, and his daughters had to write a check to the IRS for $198,000. And in his life, the thing that he hated almost more than sons-in-law were having to pay taxes. He lost out all the way around. So really ask that question of, are there some things that I need to be doing in relationship to my current giving that could change things? Beneficiary designations are an important thing to make sure, particularly in this day and time. Most people will take their IRAs, 401ks, and on that beneficiary designation line, if mom is still alive, you're going to put mom, or if dad's still alive, you're going to put dad, and then you put the kids as secondary. The trouble with all of that is those get taxed at a much different level. And I've seen families actually create significant taxable events for the kids in the estate because of those beneficiary designations. Some people will actually do those beneficiary designations for the charities that they want to support and then replace the value of that money with some life insurance. And those are questions to ask, because that doesn't create that kind of taxable event for the kids. You can, you know, depending on how much there is, you can easily get in the 55 to 60% category taxes on the IRA's 401ks. This is a good point for me to also remind you that one of the provisions that our government has allowed us now is to be able to make a gift from your required minimum distribution up to $100,000 a year. You have to follow certain procedures. You can't just say, send me the money and I'll send it to St. David's. You have to write the administrator of your plan, say, I want this, you know, I want X amount to go to St. David's. They're gonna cut the check and send it to St. David's. But you can do that. It really is a wonderful way for folks who are not ready to take the required minimum distribution on their IRA. I recommend that you really take a look at that. You do not get a charitable deduction. Even before we changed the exemption status under the new tax law, you never got a charitable deduction, but what you did get, it did not count as income. So it kind of becomes a nice wash at that point. So it's a way to make, if you're not relying upon that required minimum distribution, and a lot of people aren't yet, it's a way to make a gift and not increase your income. I just think that's something to always keep in mind. And if you're dealing with a 401k, you'll have to roll that 401k over into an IRA. It's not a big deal, but it has to come out of the IRA. I will tell you there's legislation pending right now that the president has said he would sign, and I believe it's passed the House, it's now back in the Senate, that will extend the required age to take required minimum distribution from 70 and a half to 72. And it will allow people to make contributions past that 70 and a half. They can continue to make. What they're trying to do is figure out a way to help the number of people who didn't do a particularly good job in planning their retirement.
I think he's already signed it.
Has he already signed it? Okay, because
the Secure Act.
Yeah, that's. I've been out of news touch. I have a hard time staying in touch with news now anyway because just it's so weird. But I've been traveling, and thank you for sharing that act has been signed, because that does make a real difference. The ultimate question, I think, is, as you look at that legacy plan, we work with the attorney, we work with the tax advisor, is does that plan accomplish all my goals? You know, that's really what you want to make sure that plan does, that it accomplishes all of those goals. So let's just close out looking at some questions for you. Again, time and time again, I will say, are my plans up to date? Have things changed? Are there extra grandchildren that have shown up? You know, I just dealt with a family whose son married a young woman with two children. And all of a sudden, they've gone from two grandchildren to four grandchildren, with an expectation of the son that his two stepchildren will now be part of the estate. Mom and dad aren't real sure about that. So there's some family tension and some real need for some discussion around all of that. So look at the estate plan that you have. See if things have changed. Is it out of date? Have the properties changed? A number of items. I really recommend that you look at your will at least every 2 years just to see what's actually changed out there. Have I talked to my family about all this? And this is not about talking to my family about what I'm going to give them. It's talking to my family about what I'm going to impart to them. Because at this point in a legacy plan, you really do have a chance to say, here's what's been important to us. This is why we're giving to St. David's. This is why we're giving to the university. This is why we're giving to the ballet. Because it's been special times for us. Some of our best memories are at St. David's, and on and on and on. Imparting to the family why you're doing the planning that you're doing. And I will tell you that adult children hate those conversations. They absolutely hate them. We tried to sit down with our five children at one time. Even after two, three bottles of wine, we sat down with them. That didn't work. So we actually had to make trips and sit down individually with them and say, we're gonna sit here and you're gonna listen to what we have to tell you because it's important. We're doing what we're doing for these reasons. We're naming the administrator that we've named for this reason. We're naming this person to handle medical directives for me, this person to handle medical directives, you know, for your mom. This is why we're doing what we're doing. And these are why we're making the gifts that we make. Because the church has been important in our marriage, in our life. We want you to know that. And by the way, we're also active and involved in Organization X. And we're going to leave them some money as well. So we're going to impart this information. We're going to impart, hopefully, some wisdom and some knowledge to them. Are you sharing that legacy? Have you let St. David's know? One of the things, and I wanted to make sure, that's why I sent you the email that I did, you know, do you, have you done your funeral plans as well? You know, that's what happens a lot of times. I see folks get to this really critical time in life, and the kids show up and they can't remember mom's favorite hymn. You know, they know that she had one, but they're not sure what it was, and so you wind up playing Smoke Gets in Your Eyes at the funeral, rather so, which is probably not good if it's a cremation. But I'm sorry. But you know, there are forms that April can provide you that you can put on file here at the church that will save your family a lot of grief. I want to close with a quick story about room 218. Memorial Day weekend, we were visiting, three couples were visiting a friend of ours in Minnesota who 5 years before that on Memorial Day weekend was in the process of moving from Denver to South Dakota. He was at his new place in South Dakota, was going to fly home to Denver, and he and his wife are going to make the move over Memorial Day weekend. He's running late, he's coming down the steps with two suitcases, tumbles, doesn't let go of the suitcases, rolls down the steps, hits the floor, and slides across the floor, through the wall, into the kitchen. Survived, but is now quadriplegic. So we traveled to visit him. He's in a nursing home. And it was so fascinating. We went out to dinner, we had a picnic, we did all sorts of things for that weekend. But on that Sunday afternoon, we're sitting out on the porch of this nursing home. And a van pulls up. And his name's John. And John said, "That's the undertaker." They recognized the van. No markings on it, but they knew what it was. "That's the undertaker." And he said, "It's probably Ted. He's in 218. He's been sick." And from that point on, no one ever referred to Ted by name. They referred to 218. People gathered out on the porch. The residents were talking. And it was always about 218. Ted's family had come, gathered his belongings, daughter, her husband, and a granddaughter, adult granddaughter. As they were leaving, I just felt somewhat compelled to say, "You know, I'm sorry for your loss." And so we talked a little bit, and I said, tell me about your dad or your granddad. And so we talked maybe a total of 5 or 10 minutes, and they shared stories about him. And the granddaughter said, "You know, he taught me everything that's important in life." And I thought, wow. You know, the more I reflected on that is, I don't want to be known as being in 218. I want to be known for who I am. But I hope that there's somebody in my life that will say, "God, he taught me everything that was important." That begins to happen when you do good legacy planning. You're able to impart that. You're able to share that. I want to close with what I think is one of the best theologians around, Mr. Rogers. We live in a world in which we need to share responsibility. It's easy to say, "It's not my child, not my community, not my world, not my problem." Then there are those who see the need and respond. I consider those people my heroes. And if nothing else I want to impart today, it's that when you do good legacy planning, and you remember the work of St. David's, and you remember the work of those organizations you care about, for your family, for your community, for the world in which you live, you truly do become a hero. So don't pass up that opportunity. Make sure you do that kind of planning so that at some point, somebody says about you, he's a hero, she's a hero. She taught me what I needed to know in life that was important. So let me see if there are questions that you have, because we're getting close to the end here. That's a wonderful point that because of those beneficiaries.
They go first.
That's why you want to look at who I'm designated as beneficiaries. And then the use of a trust can make a real difference. I don't think it's stupid. I mean, this is pretty complicated stuff. I mean, this is why I recommend, you know, this was your attorney who brought this out to you. I don't think it's stupid at all. I think it's that we get so caught up in not knowing, and it changes so often. You know, every time you turn around, it's, you know, some aspect of the law changes a lot. But it's a very, very good point that you really look at those things and begin to say, okay, do I really, and I know my wife and I, everything we own is in the name of a trust. And whoever dies first, which I'm sure will be me, whoever dies first, everything, you know, she gets use of all of that. And then at her death, we've specified how things are going to go among the five kids, because it's a blended marriage. And there's some property that came to her from her family that needs to stay with her three kids. And so we've got all of that spelled out in the trust.
One other thing that I learned, and this is how we got to it, by designating a person as my durable power of attorney, he said, well, if you become a quadriplegic or you can't talk or you're on life support or whatever, you know how difficult it's going to be for her to access money unless you put it all in a trust? Because she's going to have to go to this entity and that entity.
Putting things in a trust can be time-consuming initially, but I will tell you that in the long run, it's a wonderful way to go to make sure that your legacy plan is carried out the way you want it to be. It also goes a long way in helping families not fight or helping families not be confused, because all of that becomes a very confusing time and a very difficult time. Family. So thank you for sharing that.
I was going to pass on some information to Dr. Mark, my financial planner, about that discussion with the kids. I know when my dad tried to discuss that with me, he spent 5 minutes of him saying, no, I'm not going to die, and I'm okay, and I don't want, you know, I was like, you know, Dad, you're 80, I get it, you're going to die, so you can say, well, die. But that uncomfortable part, our financial planner uses the term, if I had died yesterday, this is what you would need to know today. And it's such a great phrase, so you're not telling your kids, you know, they're obligated to say, oh, you know, it just gets rid of all. If I died yesterday, this is what you'd be dealing with today. This is where things are. This is how much there is. These are the people to call. And so I'm just, that phrase has been wonderful for us.
Yeah, that's very, very good. Because, you know, I've talked with families after mom's died or dad's died. There's no survivors. And all the kids are saying, we're not sure who their attorney is. We're not sure who to call. We're not sure even what bank that they deal with, you know, because those are all, I know we provide, I'm guessing you probably do, if not I can send you a copy. We provide a workbook.
It's in the
Okay, great. That has all of that information. That's number one, if you fill it out before you go visit your attorney, you will have most of the questions answered that he or she's going to ask you. Number two, your kids, your family ought to have a copy of that, because it says, here's where my will is located. I've seen people, you know, kids going, we don't even know where the will is. Here's where the will is located. Here's the attorney. Here's the attorney's phone number. Here's the funeral director's number. I mean, those are practical, and I think that's a good way of putting it. If I had died yesterday, this is what you would need to know. It's still a tough conversation, but they're practical, everyday needs that need to be addressed. And when you're dealing with the loss of a loved one, the mind's a little fuzzy, you know? It really is. It's just a little fuzzy because it's a shock. Even if you knew it was coming, it's still a shock. You're never prepared for that. You're never prepared to lose a parent or a child, or, you know, you're just never prepared for that. Although I am convinced that if I had a sprained ankle, my wife might pull the plug, but I'm not sure.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.